You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of March 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's show, Vladimir Putin announces new nuclear-capable missiles aimed squarely at combating the USA. Was today the official start of the new Cold War? My guests, Linda Yu and Sebastian Borgia, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including...
I hope to have some more clarity about the UK's plans next week when I meet Prime Minister May in London.
That day has arrived. Donald Tusk tells the UK to buck up its ideas when it comes to Brexit. We'll ask whether the country's politicians have actually run out of them. We'll also be looking at the true value of tech as the sector rises to a 25% market share stateside. And as the beast from the East Blizzard continues to batter Europe, we'll look at why the media loves to cook up a storm. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome indeed to Midori House. My guests today are Linda Yu, broadcaster and author of The Great Economists, How Their Ideas Can Help Us Today, and Sebastian Borgo, London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung. Welcome both to the programme. Very good to have you with us. To start, amid the paranoia, ever-present suspicion and generally sub-zero relations between the United States and Russia lately, one ingredient necessary for the official reawakening of the Cold War has been conspicuously absent, a nuclear standoff. But no more. Today, Vladimir Putin unveiled new lines in strategic nuclear-capable weapons, some of which he calls invincible. And he also harked back to the antics of the 1970s, if we can term them thus, while doing so, saying, "You didn't listen to our country then," and added, "Listen to us now." Linda, at the risk of asking, I guess, an obvious question, given Vladimir Putin is thinking about domestic elections, why is this happening now?
I think he feels emboldened probably on several fronts. And I think the fact that Donald Trump is an unpredictable president in lots of ways, including in foreign policy, I think he felt it was probably a good time for him to assert his own strongman credentials. And I think what was really disturbing about his very long speech on this topic is that...
Well, welcome to that.
He said that they've been secretly developing this capability for a long time. And I think that to me is actually really quite disturbing because obviously before Trump, Trump's only been in office for a year. Under President Obama, the aim was for... The elimination, the removal of nuclear weapons, nuclear non-proliferation was the theme, and how quickly things have changed.
Sebastian, that's an interesting point, isn't it? Non-proliferation, very much the watchwords of the Obama administration. And precisely as Linda says, it's interesting. Putin's clearly suggesting that this has been an ongoing program. Is he, though, merely saying and doing what is politically expedient for Vladimir Putin today? Or does this maybe speak to the fact that this was something that he had in his locker for a while, and it can't be merely dismissed as today's saber-rattling?
Well, first of all, I mean, I've spent this afternoon longer than I should have done, really, with my favorite book, which is Military Balance of the International Institute for Strategic Studies. Now, they describe, for example, in great detail, the RS-28 Sarmat missile, which was one of the ones that Putin highlighted in his speech. And they commented that... This rocket's development has been postponed several times due to technical difficulties. So, you know, this is not some secret program. Mm. We know that both the U.S. and the, and I was going to say the Soviet Union, and I beg your pardon, Russia were developing new weapons capable of carrying nuclear warheads. Now, that in this case, the RS-28 is interesting because the Defense Ministry is now saying they have had a successful test. But, you know, a lot of the other stuff, a hypersonic missile, A cruise missile powered by a nuclear reactor? I mean, this sounds to me a little bit James Bondy. I haven't been able to talk to one of the experts of the ISS, but I would put a large amount of salt to all of that.
Well, I was going to say a pinch of salt maybe. But Linda, I guess to come back to the point you were sort of alluding to with your first answer, we do have a sort of, you know, unpredictable, self-styled strongmen in both the key seats of power in Moscow and in Washington, D.C. And in a sense, that in and of itself takes us back to, you know, some of the dicier moments of Cold War One, if we can call it that. We don't want to be relentlessly negative or pessimistic, but is it wrong to look back, or is it, again, always instructive to look to history because that's often where the most valuable lessons lie?
Well, those who don't know the lessons of history are doomed to repeat its worst mistakes. I do think it's a very interesting change, I think, in the international mood. Regardless of whether Russia has this capability, it's a little bit like North Korea. They may or may not have this capability. But I think we have moved from an era where the accepted norm was consensual, multilateral disarmament. Of course, we knew that America is still the leading spender on arms and all of that. But I feel that era has almost certainly ended. Now there is a feeling that these leaders are boasting or demonstrating their capabilities. That takes us into a very different era. In fact, President Trump, as you know, wants a military parade to show off everything that America has. And I quite worry this is leading us down to, down the route to another maybe Cold War II, maybe something else, but certainly a fracturing of the international consensus that, we are all entering into a cooperative era rather than this saber-rattling distrust, unpredictability, all the things that you can recall from the Cold War before it ended in the late 80s.
Can I just say that this consensus that you talk about has been dead and buried for at least 10 to 15 years? I mean, Putin, much as I hate taking Putin's side, but what he what he's referring to, of course, is Bush, George Bush the Younger, fair, in 2002 abandoning the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty. So this is not new territory. What is new is that we've over the years quite rightly concentrated on Russia's economic performance, which is dire and still is. I mean, he talked, of course, in his overlong speech about getting about 20 million of his people out of poverty, which leaves still another 25 million or something. And the life expectancy, if you compare it to America or other developed nations, is abysmal. So there's lots of things which isn't going right in Russia, but we have noticed over the last 5 to 6 years the development of the arms budget in all sorts of ways, not least this the strategic weaponry, and that's been around all the time. I can't see that consensus that you are hopefully talking about. That's been gone for a while. Obama made all the right noises. Nothing happened.
I think it's the noises I miss, if I'm honest.
We could take joy or comforts where we could, Linda. I probably agree with you on that.
I think it's the language. I see this on a number of fronts, not just militarily, but also China's another example. I think there's a real sort of sense that we have our consensus around what the world should look like has fractured. And of course, it's been happening. I agree for a while, Crimea, for instance, with Russia. And then I think a lot of these issues maybe are just poking holes at the difference between rhetoric and reality of what these countries were actually doing. But as I said, Sebastian, I miss the language.
No, I agree. We like that kind of language. But I mean, the facts on the ground have been there for a while. I think the much more interesting development this week, apart from Putin's saber rattling, which you know, Tom, you've quite rightly, I think, identified as electioneering, is President Xi's decision to basically throw away the Chinese constitution.
Sure.
and wanting to go on and on and on.
That's a good good example of this strongman rise that I think is worrying.
Well, and of course, this consolidation that we're seeing in Beijing is interesting. And just to get briefly before we move on Putin specifically, I wonder what the view back home is as well, Sebastian, about Putin's, we've said it's electioneering. We know that he's a strongman, self-styled, but he's consolidated his grip on power. Even allowing the caveat for today that he is doing some early, well, not early, some electioneering. Is there an ongoing broad concern? We know that he's aggressive, he's belligerent in his rhetoric, but he is still playing principally just to his domestic audience. I guess, does that reassure, I don't know, those watching from Berlin, for example?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing from my perspective was that I watched over the afternoon, I watched the German-speaking news websites, and his speech doesn't, almost no mention of it, which tells you a lot about Germany's complete inability to think strategically still still totally wrapped up in their silly coalition talks, which of course, which to be fair, of course, the Social Democrats will have to the deadline is tomorrow, and they'll tell us the result on Sunday. So Germany is basically still putting its head in the sand.
And Linda, just to pick up on that point you did make earlier, overlong, I think, was one, overwrought, overscripted, whatever you want to call it. One thing that Vladimir Putin definitely isn't learning is how to be a little more succinct with his speeches. But that's very much his personal style. He's not going to, if anything, he's probably only going to get worse, one imagines.
Yeah, I don't think there's any incentive for him to improve there.
2 hours, I bet you. I mean, Castro did manage 8. You know, come on, have a little bit patience.
Be careful. He's the kind of man, set in the challenge, he'll rise to it. So let's move on. European Council President Donald Tusk has been back in the UK today. He visited Theresa May to deliver to her the surely fairly sane message that the UK needs to come up with a better idea than the mess it's currently needlessly creating on the border between Ireland and Northern Ireland specifically. The UK has been consumed by political deadlock, indecision since the referendum, and the lack of positive, creative political thought to fill the vacuum has been glaring. Sebastian, are there no ideas in British politics at the moment, or are there no British politicians with any ideas, and are those two things different?
There are ideas, and they are obvious, but they're just not being taken up by the Conservative government, which is, as far as I can see, now entirely led by hard Brexiteers. In other words, people who hate the European Union enough to cause considerable economic damage to both countries in the European Union, but I think to a larger extent to Britain. Of course, propped up by people who hate the EU even more, namely the Protestant Unionists in Northern Ireland, who don't even speak for the majority of their people. The ideas are on the table. I mean, you've got what is normally termed a soft Brexit. In other words, stay close, economically and politically close to the EU without being a member. Switzerland manages it. Norway manages it. In different shades, you know, we can discuss, do you want to stay in the single market?
And at a price or at different prices. And even that seems to be unacceptable to these right-leaning...
But that's the problem. You know, I understand this is the sixth largest economy in the world. This is a former empire. This is a country with atomic weapons, if only few, a seat on the Security Council. This is a country that still matters in the world. And these people want it to matter. And that's fine. But I think they've drawn the wrong conclusion. I think it matters much more in conjunction with its European friends and allies. Let's not forget that, you know. Very close in all sorts of ways, economically, militarily, just as societies, very close friends and partners. They've drawn the wrong conclusion, as far as I can see, and are dragging the UK into isolationism. But there are other people on this political stage in Britain. I find it incomprehensible that the Irish Nationalist Party, Sinn Féin, looking at Westminster and seeing that the UK Parliament is very finely in the balance and is still insisting on this 100-year-old policy of not taking up seats in Westminster, even though we have a settlement, we have agreed between the UK and Ireland that Ireland can only be reunited with democratic means. It's all sorted. They still refuse to take their place where they could actually make a difference. So, you know, there's lots of politicians around, as far as I can see, in this country and on the other island, who refuse to look at reality and act accordingly.
I probably agree with that diagnosis as well. Linda, it's interesting. You talked almost poetically earlier about failing to ignore the lessons of history. You've written about the lessons we can learn from the great economic theorists of the past. And to sort of pick up on what Sebastian's been saying there, everybody seems to be ignoring all of those lessons or not even having the conversation about why it matters to try and learn them. Why is that happening? Is it the bloody-mindedness, does that come from entrenched ideology? Is it ignorance? Is it aggression? Is it Euroscepticism? Is it base stupidity? Why does it happen? Because I can't explain it.
It's cognitive dissonance, I think. So they've done some studies about whether or not rational arguments or facts can persuade a person. But once your mind is made up, you experience cognitive dissonance if the facts and the arguments presented to you are different than what you believe. And I think ultimately Brexit is about ideology. So there are people who believe is the better thing to do, who believe we'll be better off. And I think it's very difficult to reconcile the two sides, which is obviously the British government's problem. You've got people who have this very strong ideology, others who are probably just trying to get through it. And then there are others who really think we ought to remain. My personal hope is that those who are in the middle trying to get through it will come up with something, because it's very clear from Donald Tusk's visit today to Downing Street and Michel Barnier, who gave a speech as well. He's the EU Brexit negotiator, of course. So he and Tusk are key players. And both of them have said very clearly the UK doesn't have a proposal. They've put out a proposal for the transition. And a contentious part within that is that to avoid a hard border in Ireland, there will have to be regulatory alignment between Northern Ireland and the EU. That implies there will be a border between Britain and Ireland and Northern Ireland. And they've said, if you don't like this idea, then come up with something else. And I think that, to me, is an invitation for British policymakers to come back and say, okay, well, these are the things that we envision, and they probably need to do it realistically. They're never going to get frictionless trade, which is the term that's often used. And that was definitively knocked down by Barnier today, who said, unless you are in the single market and a customs union, there you cannot have frictionless trade, because everything that passes the border will be checked. So they need to come up with something which is not based on models that don't exist and may not exist.
And then to my point, which I was alluding to, which we've probably talked about before on this program, about some moribund state of the political classes in this country, I still fear, despite that absolutely clear and rational picture and the obvious demands from our counterparts in Brussels, there isn't anyone with the political moxie nor the savoir-faire or the operating skills even to deliver that very rational and, to our obviously collective minds, fairly straightforward position. Is there a problem here with the actual personnel? Are we just short, good politicians from wherever they are on the spectrum?
I think we're short people who have experience with trade and economics. And I think, to be honest, this is kind of a long-standing issue, worsened by, of course, the fact that Britain hasn't had to do trade policy since 1973. But there's a great quote by J.K. Galbraith that I actually quote in my book. He says, he was an advisor, obviously, to JFK and lots of presidents. He said, "I've never met a president who was overburdened by knowledge of economics." So I think fundamentally, there's probably a gap there anyways. But it's absolutely worsened by the fact that British politicians and policymakers haven't really done trade. And those who have, the British civil servants in Brussels who have, my understanding is many of them very happy in their jobs and they're actually staying in Brussels. So they're not here back in London because they're part of the European civil service. So I think there is expertise is definitely an issue.
Which perhaps speaks volumes on its own. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, with Sebastian Borger and Linda Yu. Coming up next, tech and what it's worth to the world and the US stock market.
From the rise of pet furniture to a raft of new museums and a fresh breed of political provocateurs, there are plenty of reasons to look forward to 2018. Luckily, we've packed lots of them into more than 200 pages of the new edition of the Monocle Forecast. It's a magazine for those who want to look beyond the horizon and spot the new opportunities the new year will bring. We'll look at the political conversations you'll be having, the startups to invest in, and the cities you'll want to call home. The Forecast is packed with opinion and wit, with ideas and provocations, and guaranteed to keep you talking all the way through 2018.
You're listening to Midori House. Still with me are Sebastian Borger and Linda Yu. Tech brands now make up a quarter of the US stock market. This week, the sector peaked at just over 25% of the S&P 500 in the States, a market share high not seen for the past 17 years. It's stoked conversations of the stock market falling prey to a dot-com bubble-style collapse. But it's also had many asking what tech and the way we use it's actually worth. Need we remind that this valuation comes just weeks after a flippant social media remark from a Kardashian, not sure which one, knocked billions off the value of Snapchat. Is the value of tech here today gone tomorrow? Linda Yu, what is new technology worth? There's an easy question for you.
I think there is a argument that the tech companies today are producing not just software, but also hardware. So some of the very high-value tech companies are the most valuable brands in the world. Apple, Facebook, not really a hardware company, but I use that as a contrast to what happened in the dot-com bubble. So when that burst in 2000 to 2002, that was the very early stages of the internet. And you had companies which, and I'm sure these companies still exist today, which weren't really producing much, but whereas the companies today are changing the way that we live. Now, that doesn't imply that the valuations are somehow not too high. I think almost certainly if you look at some of the price-to-equity ratios of these companies, they're very high. I think what that implies is that we don't know how to value some of these tech companies. They're also caught up in this massive animal spirits about the belief that technology, these tech companies are changing the world. And then, of course, there's the fact that the S&P 500 itself, this benchmark index, has hit something like 25 highs last year. So they're also boiled by the overall market, but outperforming it. Because if you wanted to get in on the market, you'll be attracted to the sexier stocks like tech. So I think psychology plays a big part in it. But I think fundamentally what happens to this bubble, there must be some type of bubble in the stock market, tech sectors not excluded, is when will we begin to see whether or not what they're producing is genuinely of value and not here today, gone tomorrow. And I think That's a huge issue for a sector which is characterized by disruption, disruptors, and what was MySpace today is Facebook tomorrow.
And it's interesting, isn't it, Sebastian? If we look at that idea of disruptive influences and this history of bubbles, you know, we could have been having this conversation about, what was it, tulips back in the 18th century or whatever. Why do we remain, is it herd mentality? It's interesting, Linda's talking about aspects of psychological theory and principle in here. Why do we have this inability maybe to discern value when ostensibly we should be able to make, you know, some almost pretty straightforward mathematical judgments about valuations?
Well, I mean, economists have never been very good at differentiating between price and value, have they? So to some extent, stock markets are all, as Linda pointed out, about psychology and people wanting to put their money in a place where they hope for good returns. Returns, of course, on products or services which they don't necessarily take any interest in. I mean, I think there is a grave difference between Apple and Facebook, as Linda has pointed out. Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, all of which, were they turned off tonight by Mr. Putin or Mr. Trump or whoever, would we really suffer? Would we, would we care?
There could be an explosion in productivity.
If Apple's software, however, collapsed tonight, we'd be the proverbial creek.
Well, I'd lose my script immediately. Yeah. Well, I'd be in all sorts of bother. I wonder though, Linda, does this come from a good place? Because the idea of tech and people literally and metaphorically, I guess, buying in, and the market to a degree, buying into the sector, does it speak to a willingness, a desire to engage with a digital future, a connected future, where we optimize labor and all of these sort of positive things? Is that the quiet voice of optimism saying, hang on, maybe this comes from a good place, or is that not really a factor here?
No, I think that plays a very big part. I think what's also driving some of this belief that these tech companies are going to transform the world is because a lot of them have already begun to transform the way we work, not just consumer goods, but also robotics in factories, the inventions around 3D printing, some of the incredible work that's been done on AI. And I think we are facing a world in which technology, automation, robotics, driverless cars, they are going to change the way we are. And I think that fuels this belief that if you were to buy the companies which are at the vanguard of this, you would be doing very well. And I think that certainly has to be why tech is now more than a quarter of the market cap of the S&P 500, and why the biggest companies in the world, the Googles, the Apples, are actually tech companies. They're much bigger than the old industrial firms. And that is certainly reflecting a shift in the economy itself. But of course, what's difficult to discern in this era of tech is which ones are truly what we would call general purpose technologies, as in raising the productivity of the economy, and then therefore have a lasting value, and which ones are more frivolous, the ones that maybe we spend too much time on during the day.
Mentioning no names, even though we did earlier. Time is short, but I did want to ask you both briefly. We're avid consumers of newspapers here at Monocle. Sometimes the printed page doesn't bring you quite close enough, though, especially when the story's in your hometown. The New York Times described the UK's current blizzard conditions, the beast from the east, as having provoked panic on the streets of London. But I would say here in London, the reaction's been slightly more muted, amused, bit of confusion, mainly just people getting on with it. Sebastian, a seasoned newspaper man, of course, have you witnessed panic-consuming Londoners, or are we just getting on with it?
No,
things?
I haven't. But can I just briefly put in a word for this New York Times colleague? In fact, what he is describing, of course, is are the panicked headlines of the British tabloids. And that's what we newspaper correspondents from all over the world do all the time. By that, of course, expressing our amusement at the British tabloids, not necessarily the British public, although the British public is extraordinarily badly prepared for something which is, what, minus 5 degrees and a little bit of wind? Come on.
It's a little brisk. Linda, we did sort of in a microcosm test you in the same way, because I get our green room before the Midori House programme, a little on the chilly side. I know you still had to keep your coat on. In a word or two, are we just ill-prepared Londoners for a cold snap?
I think we've actually coped very well. It happens once in a while. We get on with it.
There you go. A message of stoicism to end the programme, perhaps appropriately given some of the other big problems we've been dealing with. Linda Yu and Sebastian Borgia, thank you both for joining us on Midori House. Today, the programme was produced by Tom Hall, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Stephanie Sakir, and our studio manager was David Stevens. Thanks to them all. Music next, 1900. Andrew Tuck is here with The Urbanist, and we'll have more on all the big stories of the day on the Monocle Daily at 2200 London time. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you for listening.